Hello, everybody. This is Nick Deolius. You're listening to the Far Middle Podcast, episode 45. I do have some breaking news for you at the very start. President Biden, if you haven't seen it, he's just announced that he's instructed the federal government to proceed with the construction of the Keystone Pipeline. He's also instructed Climate Czar Kerry to do a full scopes 1-3 accounting of the carbon footprint of wind and solar. And the Climate Czar has concluded those carbon footprints of each are egregious, which is now resetting his thinking on energy policy and climate change policies. And last but not least, President Biden has instructed the cabinet to develop a balanced budget for this year moving forward with the federal government so we don't add to the national debt. Now, if any of those or all of those got you excited, I'm sorry to tell you that's an early April Fool's joke on you a couple of days before April 1st. And unfortunately, we're living in a world today, ladies and gentlemen, where such rational, logical things are, unfortunately, satire and fake news. But nevertheless, welcome to episode 45. As I said, we are going to dedicate this episode to my favorite pitcher of all time, which is the great Bob Gibson. Now, he was in his prime a little bit before my time, so I didn't get a real good chance to see him perform in his prime in the late 60s and early 70s. But I became a big fan of his, just sort of watching and studying and listening to my dad, my uncles about baseball through the years. And I got a chance to meet Bob Gibson a few times. Very gracious individual, great human being. But, from what I could tell and what I've seen and what I've heard, he was not so gracious when he was playing. When he was on the mound, he was the ultimate intimidator when it came to the game of baseball. You never saw him crack a smile when he was pitching. Two times World Series winner. He did that twice. In 1967, in the World Series, he pitched 3 complete game victories. So think about that. 7-game series, 3 victories for the Cardinals, all three of them complete games by Bob Gibson. What an accomplishment. He, of course, was the World Series MVP in 67. In 1968, though, that was his most magical, most special year for him. It was also the most magical year for pitching in general. It was the year of the pitcher, as many baseball historians like to denote when it comes to 1968. That's also the year, by the way, when Denny McClain went with 31 wins in the season, which is a pretty amazing feat, thinking about that one. But Gibson in 68, ERA, set a record for the live ball era, 1.12 season ERA, 13 shutouts in the 68 season, 28 complete games. Bob Gibson pitched 28 complete games in 1968. Most pitchers today don't have half of those complete games in their entire career. And in game 1 of the 68 World Series against the Tigers, and Denny McClain was playing for the Tigers at the time in 68, as I mentioned. But in game 1 of that 68 series, Gibson, he struck out 17 batters in game 1 of the World Series. He was the league MVP in 1968, deservedly so. When he retired, Gibson was second in all-time strikeouts. The only guy that had more at the time was Walter Johnson. I think you heard of him before. And he was one of the players, Bob Gibson, that was, of course, to change the game. I said it before. If you want one of the true proxies or signs for greatness in sports, were they so dominant, were they so good that they ultimately ended up changing the rules of the game? Gibson certainly did that. They lowered the mound in baseball from 15 inches to 10 inches because of him to try to sort of take away some of the advantages that the pitcher might have. And they also tightened the strike zone with batters, sort of giving the batters a bit of a leg up there, largely because of Bob Gibson's dominance. I don't know if you had a chance to indulge in sports books of late, or if you like certain sort of topics when it comes to sports writing. There is an awesome book, if you do, that's titled October 1964, written by a very well-renowned author, David Halberstam. And he wrote October 64, that basically is a great read, has Gibson play prominently throughout it, the Cardinals play prominently throughout it, as well as the Yankees at the time. So just sort of great characters from Mantle and Maris, Bob Gibson, Lou Brock, Kurt Flood's in there. It's just a great read. So the only book I could recommend ahead of October 64 at this point in time is Precipice, which has already been released. I hope you've already ordered and have now received your copy and are getting through it. But give David Halberstam, in all seriousness, a read for his October 64 book. He's written some other awesome books, of course. Another good baseball book as well to October 64. But I think that might be his best overall. Really enjoyed that. So, you know, Bob Gibson, he comes along, dominates in the late 60s. Baseball has to change its rules, right? You change as conditions change. That's a good dot to start connecting. And we can jump to the subject of government and mass transit, because today mass transit usage is dropping to all-time lows, and it shows no signs of recovering to pre-pandemic levels, yet government's ignoring the reality, and it's just throwing more and more money at a losing proposition. Now, why is mass transit ridership down? I think we all know the trends that are driving this, right? Less people are working. We talked about that problem in prior episodes of The Far Middle. The people who are working, less of them are doing so in major downtown buildings. So whether it's remote work or hybrid work, there's just less traffic of workers who are working to head to major urban or downtown areas. And technology has disrupted mass transit. You've got ride hailing, which reigns supreme. It's a much better experience than mass transit. So technology has eroded a lot of the market share of mass transit. And schedules have been cut. They've been cut because of lack of workers. They've been cut because of a lack of riders. And they've been cut or sort of segmented into smaller pieces because of inept government management, or a combination of all three. And then when all this is going on, fares go up. Crime is out of control. I see the same stories that you do. The New York City subway system is a great example, where you got daily stories of violent crimes ranging from homicides all the way down to lesser crimes that are just occurring time after time in the middle of the day. It's sort of frightening and scary when you look at it in summation. So you take all this together, and it's not a surprise that no one wants to take the bus or the subway or the train. And you really can't blame them, can you? But we can certainly force them to, as far as government is concerned. And government, as I said, they can force taxpayers to keep feeding a failed system with more and more money. I took a look at the most recent daily ridership of the top five mass transit systems when I was prepping for this episode of The Far Middle. And the data are pretty compelling. It showed for those top five mass transit systems, 25% to 55% ridership levels compared to what it was before pandemic. So this sort of follows what we covered in the prior Far Middle episode on those super low office occupancy rates in major cities, right? We talked about how office occupancy rates in downtown areas have never recovered anything close to what they were before pandemic. Well, it's not a surprise if those occupancy rates are very low, because of remote work or people not working anymore or hybrid work schedules, that ridership on mass transit is going to follow that and also see a significant decline. And indeed it has. Again, looking at some of the data, Boston's MBTA rail system, which by the way got over $2 billion of COVID relief funds, is a great example. It went from 120,000 weekday passenger trips before pandemic to now at about 45,000 weekday passenger trips that it's experiencing now. So a huge drop off in its ridership volume. Chicago with a metro system, not much better. It's at 25% of its usual load. Usual is defined before pandemic. And then New York City, if you look at those big three rail systems in the New York City area, on average, they're at about 30% of pre-pandemic levels. So you don't need all this data that I just quoted to know what's going on with mass transit. You can just look around. Many of you know I live in the Pittsburgh area. I look around my neighborhood. Typically, the buses are empty or close to it. A lot of times, I'm looking at the bus. The only person on the bus is the driver himself or herself. And I'm not sure what the carbon footprint per rider is on that type of a situation, but I got to assume it's pretty egregious. And I don't know what the cost per passenger is in those situations, but I got to assume it's even uglier than the carbon footprint. You know, we'd be better off if we just scaled back a lot of our mass transit, and for whoever is still in need of a ride that was sort of a victim of the scaling back, we basically just paid for them to get a ride hailing service to take them to and from where they need to go if it's work. I think it would be way cheaper, way more friendly to the environment, way more efficient, and frankly, way more enjoyable for the rider herself or himself. But instead, I think that's the last thing you should expect. So what should you expect? Our spendthrift politicians will keep feeding the bureaucratic beast with billions and billions of dollars in federal, state, and local funds to keep the rails greased, and I assume pun intended on that comment. Which sort of brings me to the next dot to connect. While we're not following the traffic data flows for mass transit, we're also ignoring the money flows when it comes to who or what is funding environmental groups in the Western world. How come as we talk about sanctions and stopping the enablers and associates of Putin, oligarchs, etc., that nobody is asking where the money sort of trail goes back to when you look at environmental groups in the Western democracies. Could it be that some of these environmental groups get some of their funding from offshore entities that are in turn funded from sources stretching back to places like Russia or places like China? I think a sort of accounting of those money flows would tell us quite a bit. But the fact is, very little is known about where the money comes from for these types of NGOs and environmental groups. And I think we need to start asking those questions and demanding transparency, because the world has changed for the worse, as we've seen in the past month or two. And if you think this is just me hypothesizing, you know, think again. Back in 2014, the NATO chief said that Russia had funded and propagandized anti-fracking sentiment in the EU. And guess what? That funding of the anti-fracking sentiment in Europe, it worked, because today, countries like Bulgaria and France and the UK and the Netherlands have banned fracking. And those are the very same countries that now have energy insecurity and energy dependence on places like Russia, which is emboldening and enabling people like Putin to invade places like the Ukraine. Why not hold environmental groups and whoever is controlling them or funding them to a level of financial transparency that corporations and businesses are held to? What could they possibly be hiding? What's the harm in it? And the next time you're thinking about contributing to these environmental groups, just think long and hard about who else or what else might be funding them alongside you and what their true agendas might be. Now, I've said in the past that there were three sort of components or buckets of the anti-carbon crowd, anti-domestic energy crowd that is out there, right? The first one was that honest graft crowd. These are the corporations that are rent seekers or subsidy seekers that are looking to be the middleman or to sort of garner subsidy from the state to basically make more money, to increase their net income or their cash flows. And that's nothing new. That's always been in existence. And that's sort of how sort of bad government policymaking can couple up in bad ways with big business. We then talked about the second group or bucket, which was the government bureaucracy. Government and its bureaucracy is voracious when it comes to needing to be fed with tax dollars and regulations, and things like climate change policies, environmental policies can be a great conduit to raise proceeds and justify staffing and budget levels for government entities and to help them keep feeding at the expense of the taxpayer. And then we talked about that third bucket, which was sort of where it's become a religion. The zero carbon climate change ideology has become a religion. And these are the true believers, the zealots, so to speak. They're not interested in dollars and cents per se, or justifying a bigger bureaucracy. They just truly believe, and there's typically no reasoning with these individuals when it comes to science or math or logic. But I think I have to sort of revise that view of three big components or buckets, because I think there is a fourth, the more I think about it, a fourth component. And that is what I'll call, for lack of a better term, let's just call them America's adversaries crowd. It's entities like the Chinese Communist Party. It's entities like Russia, led by Putin, and these groups just love Western environmental groups. And the more extreme and the more anti-carbon those environmental groups are, the better from the perspective of this America's adversaries crowd. Now, is it a coincidence? Well, if you are one who speculates, like many in the media do, or many of the spin doctors out there do, that Russia or China was into Trump or was into Clinton or was into Biden's son or whoever, what do you think they might be up to when it comes to the more extreme environmental groups in the West? Do you think that same thought might also apply to those environmental groups? And while you're thinking about that, it sort of leads me to my next dot to connect, which is how increasingly there is a very visible direct link between this administration and the fiction writers that are out there supporting the left. Recently, it was sort of announced in the news that the administration and the White House was working with and meeting with TikTok influencers, of all people, and they were instructing them or giving them briefings on what's going on with the Ukraine, what's going on with Russia and Russian policy, and basically how high gas prices are the result of Vladimir Putin and what he's doing with Ukraine, and not the result of inflation and energy policy and climate change zealotry and supply chain issues and the anti-work policies and all these other things that we've seen come out of this administration over the past year plus. Now, one of the groups that the White House is working with is an advocacy group that I checked out on the web. It's a far-left group that is a partner with the White House, as I said, on Ukraine. You go to their website, the first issue that pops up on their menu is climate justice. And then the first sub-issue under the climate justice menu is ban fracking. Are you kidding me? So here we are, the White House, the leadership of this country, is partnering with an advocacy group, a leftist advocacy group, and their website has issue number one being climate justice, and the sub number one issue under climate justice is the ban fracking. And their job is to influence Americans to convince them that Vladimir Putin and his aggression is the sole thing that's driving high commodity prices, high energy prices, and inflation in general. You can't make this stuff up. It does all go to show how the current administration and politics today in general, frankly, across the board, they continue to veer away from substance, they continue to avoid reality, and they move more towards the fluff and the image. So TikTok influencers are now dictating and driving foreign policy on Pennsylvania Avenue. My, how things have changed, and boy, isn't that cause for massive concern. Now, while President Biden is using TikTok influencers to establish foreign policy, and I wonder if President Biden has ever been on TikTok. I doubt it, but it'd be an interesting question. But on that topic of foreign policy, national security, no matter who's driving it, TikTok influencers or otherwise, the social media generation is displaying a few very troubling trends that have come across the past couple of weeks. A recent poll was out there. You might have seen this. It made its rounds across a lot of the major news services. But the poll was asking a simple question. Would you stand and fight if Putin was invading the United States like he is doing with the Ukraine? So this wasn't a question about, you know, volunteering to fight for oil in some faraway land or, you know, a Vietnam situation or Iraq or Afghanistan. This was, you know, posed as the question of if the United States were invaded, would you stand and fight? Now, the poll results, they cut these results across party lines, which I'm not sure why they did that. I don't know if the party lines are as interesting to me as, say, age demographics might be. But on the Democrat side, 52% of Democrats said they would cut and run if the homeland were invaded. And one in four Republicans said they would also cut and run if invaded. Now, the actual results, if this were to actually happen, would probably be worse because, you know, when you're taking a survey, you can lie without consequences to avoid feeling like a coward. It might actually be a lot worse in reality. And the big story, as I said, was, well, more Democrats would not fight than Republicans. I don't think that's the takeaway. I'm not sure this is a partisan issue. I would be very interested, as I said, I haven't seen these results for the poll and whether they're available or not, but I'd be very interested to see how those results were stratified across different age groups. I suspect my hypothesis is that it depends on what the age group is. And my suspicion is this is another indication that is showing or blinking of how we become soft. And that's what our policies have been aiming at, to make us soft. If you look at everything from monetary policy with the Federal Reserve and the Department of Labor along with the Federal Reserve awarding work ethic, how it's just sort of eaten away at our work ethic over time, to where the military these days are focused, where it's zero carbon pledges and sensitivity training and things like that. What's going on with our education system, whether it's microaggressions or sort of celebrating victimhood, what our pandemic policies had been, where basically we've been sort of part of a nanny state. Government and the left that is really controlling government these days, it's almost as if they're genetically modifying independently minded individuals that we were into collective sheep. And that is not a good thing. And I don't want you guys to confuse this or mistake this as a call for, you know, some sort of Rambo-esque red meat type of aggression. Far from it. I mean, war clearly kills. It's not something to glorify. It is not something to run to. That's the last thing in the world any rational person should want. But I think it is about a basic question. You know, the question along the lines of, do you have conviction about this place being special? Or is it just a piece of dirt that you sleep on each night? Is this truly home, or is this just an address or a GPS set of coordinates for you? And how does this poll differ from what the poll would have shown if we took that poll in 1776 or 1812 or 1917 or 1943? Where would we be then if that was our attitude back then? And last but not least, what I'm really thinking about with this sort of results from this poll, what if our enemies, Chinese Communist Party, Russia, et cetera, Iran, et cetera, what if they're reading into this poll and they're setting their agendas and their plans accordingly? That's a frightening thought in and of itself. Now, maybe going from the scary to a bit more humorous, maybe it's still scary, it depends on where you fall out on this one, sort of frightened by it, sort of humored by it, but it's another data point showing how soft we become, or at least how soft current colleges are. And this has to do with NYU, of course, a very prestigious university. And NYU is now offering a class on, of all things, Taylor Swift. So this class is focused singularly on Taylor Swift and, I guess, her career, her music, etc. And NYU, as I said, very elite university, bastion of the left, also a bastion of elite, sort of insulated individual society in New York City. So, you know, NYU in many ways is the poster child for a lot of the issues that we've discussed in the Far Middle podcast of late. It also is not a cheap place. Its annual tuition, room and board is over $75,000 a year. And a lot of programs and degrees at NYU, despite the ultra high tuition, or maybe because of the ultra high tuition, they're not delivering job prospects that are close to paying what is needed to justify a rate of return on that massive student debt load that you take on if you wanted to attend NYU over 4 years. Now, NYU is not alone, right? You add all this up across all of academia in the United States. It's this type of thing that leads to the $1.7 trillion in student debt loans that are out there and all the other subsidies, God knows how many trillions of dollars in subsidies that are coming directly and indirectly from government to basically stack the deck in favor of academia to keep feeding that bureaucratic beast and that failed business model. Now, if you remember a while ago, episode 23 of the Far Middle podcast, I dedicated that episode to highlight six things to get our country on the right track, six simple things. And one of those six was using college endowments to cover student debt defaults and forgiveness instead of using the taxpayer and taxpayer dollars. So the idea here was if, you know, the academic model is a failed one and it doesn't reform itself, it doesn't change itself, and it is resulting in loan defaults across the board with respect to students because students can't get jobs to cover their tuition bills, why would you give academia a pass and make the taxpayer pick up the bill when it comes to loan forgiveness? Instead, what you should do is go to the party that caused the mess, which is academia, and have them tap into their endowments to cover the loan forgiveness amounts. And if you do that, not only is the taxpayer not burdened with something they didn't cause, a bill they didn't cause, but it also will catalyze reform post-haste when it comes to academia and modifying its business model to be more responsive to what's going on, whether it's tuition levels that'll be brought back in line, or whether it's better, more focused degree programs to get better job prospects for the graduates so they get great jobs that can cover and easily cover the tuition bills. Now, if we took that approach and you take NYU with their Taylor Swift class, which I'm sure in some ways, shapes, or form is going to, you know, a contributor to the $75,000 plus a year in tuition, room, and board. And I'm not sure the Taylor Swift class on the resume is going to get heightened job offers or better job offers. It might actually work against you. If I saw that on a resume, I'd almost want to ask the question, like, was that a required course? I hope it was a required course. If it was an elective, I'd have to think long and hard about the candidate in front of me. But looking at NYU, their endowment is almost $6 billion. So if you want true reform within that broken model of academia, we should make NYU or entities and institutions like it tap into those types of endowments, those multi-billion dollar endowments, whenever we're forgiving student debt or covering student defaults from graduates of that institution. We shouldn't be putting taxpayers on the hook. But I thought that Taylor Swift class at NYU would get your attention. And another example of not just how soft certain colleges have become, but also how this business model of academia and how government is continually subsidizing at our expense is leading to results that are getting worse, not better. Now, all this talk on government subsidy of academia with your money and the state funneling more of your hard-earned dollars into failed public transportation gets me thinking of Milton Friedman and his famous talk on the four ways to spend money. He gave this speech, and it's an awesome one. Check it out on YouTube if you ever get a chance. But Milton Friedman said, hey, there's four ways you can spend money. First way is you can spend your money on yourself. Now, when you're spending your money on yourself, you're bargaining hard and you get exactly what you want. So that's sort of the best of the four ways. The second way to spend money is you're spending your money, but now you're spending it for someone else. Here, you're bargaining hard, right? And you settle to get close to what you want. So when you're spending your money for someone else, like say a gift, you're going to bargain hard like you always would, but you'll settle to get close to what you want, even if it's not exactly what you want. Third way to spend money is you spend someone else's money on yourself. Now, when you're doing that, think of like expense account if you're working for a company or a business. You don't bargain hard, but you get what you want. Okay, so if you're on expense account and you go to dinner, right, if you're not being careful, you don't care what the price of the dinner is, and you're going to get exactly what you want to eat because you're not paying for it. Now, the fourth way to spend money is the worst of all worlds. This is when you spend someone else's money, and you're spending someone else's money on somebody else. So in this scenario, you're not going to bargain hard at all, and you don't care if you get what you wanted. And that is exactly how government operates. Government spending someone else's money, it's your money as a taxpayer, and government is spending your money on somebody else. So government doesn't bargain hard at all, and government in the end doesn't care if what it was spending the money on manifests in the results that it was sort of warranting or justifying the expenditures on to begin with. Now, out of those four ways to spend money, again, what do we see the most of today? And ask yourself if the most prevalent method is spending someone else's money on somebody else, how sustainable is that in the long term? Definitely some food for thought. Now, talking about fiscal sustainability, responsible government, Milton Friedman, all that good stuff, let me wrap this episode 45 of the Far Middle Podcast to remember an event that surrounded a president who makes today's ineptitude in D.C. look even worse, and that is President Ronald Reagan. March 30th is the anniversary of when Reagan was shot at the D.C. Hilton at DuPont Circle. There is still a plaque there at the side entrance of the hotel where it happened. And Reagan was there. He was exiting, and he was giving a speech to a group of organized labor. The AFL-CIO was holding an event there where he spoke at it. And John Hinckley, of course, was the gunman. He fired six shots in total. Interestingly, none of those six directly hit Reagan. So he didn't hit the president directly with any of those six shots. But Reagan was hit by one of the bullets. I think it was the last bullet that ricocheted off the bulletproof limousine, and it went into the car where the Secret Service was shoving the president into once the shots started to be fired. So he was hit by basically a ricochet of one of the bullets. James Brady, of course, his story was a tragic one tied to that event. He died ultimately in 2014. When he passed away, his death was ruled an eventual homicide because of the root cause of his demise. And John Hinckley, he, of course, was obsessed with Jodie Foster. He was obsessed with the movie Taxi Driver with Robert De Niro. He also stalked Jimmy Carter before his attempted assassination of President Reagan. And he was arrested in Nashville where President Carter was appearing. Hinckley was arrested in Nashville for illegal firearms possession. But the FBI and Secret Service, they didn't connect the dots. They didn't realize that that President Carter's appearance in Nashville and Hinckley's arrest at the airport were related. That's why Hinckley was in town. So he didn't pop up on their radar, and thus the incident with President Reagan ensued. Hinckley was ruled not guilty by reason of insanity at trial. He was released from custody in 2016. And when Brady passed away, Hinckley was never charged with the homicide. Now, this sort of not guilty by reason of insanity that came down at trial, that outraged a lot of people in the legal profession and across sort of America. And that changed significantly the defense that courts to this day will apply, the standards when that defense of not guilty by reason of insanity is raised. So Hinckley and the attempted assassination of President Reagan actually impacted criminal law to a significant extent after the event itself. Now, when Reagan was out of commission, when he was undergoing surgery and out of commission, Al Haig, who was Secretary of State, he was the person who famously said, quote, "The helm is right here," end quote. So he assumed control of the government when Reagan was out of commission. There was one little problem with Al Haig's reading of who was the helm, and that was the Constitution of the United States, because the Constitution was pretty clear and dictated that Haig would be the fourth helm, not the first one after the president. So the order of succession that the Constitution lays out is, of course, president first, then vice president, then Speaker of the House, then president of the Senate, then Secretary of State. So I guess that's your civics lesson for the week. This concludes, as I said, episode 45 of The Far Middle. I hope you enjoyed it. Precipice is now out, so if you haven't pre-ordered it, if you haven't started reading it, please do so. All the net proceeds go to the CNX Mentorship Academy, goes to a great cause. But Precipice, the Left's campaign to destroy America, more prevalent than ever, unfortunately, but in the interest of public debate and public discourse, give it a read, get engaged, get involved. I think it'll definitely be for the better. Talk to you in a week.